Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We're taking a look now at the type of school in Massachusetts that specializes in treating and educating high school students who have addictions, alcohol, drugs, including opioids. There are five of these types of high schools in the state. They're public high schools in Boston, Brockton, Springfield, Worcester, and Beverly. The first one opened up in Massachusetts in 2006. Here's a scene from an ABC Nightline documentary about a recovery high school here in Worcester. This is Principal Susan Strong speaking with a student named Harry when she suspects he may be using again.
You look pretty high right now.
No. I've done a perk.
What other stuff? So. Have you shot heroin
yet? No.
That's like a one-way road for you because you almost died. And we might not be so lucky to have two shots of Narcan to bring Harry back to us.
Oh, yeah. I feel that.
Yeah. So that's what's killing me. And that's what's killing Alyssa because we don't want that to happen.
It is a more expensive high school to run, with transportation being individualized. Low teacher-student ratio means more teachers need to be hired. And those teachers are not just teaching English and earth science, but how to stay sober. On Beacon Hill, the House budget has a couple of amendments to increase funding, and we're going to learn more about this from WBUR reporter Allison Poley. Thanks for coming into the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about the schools and about the students and their needs in overall?
Of course. So as you mentioned, these are public schools, and the students who are attending are struggling with substance abuse disorders. And that includes everything from alcoholism to opioid addictions. Now, the schools are small. They average only a few dozen students, and they have create sober environments where the kids have access to group therapy, to mental health counselors, and to a recovery counselor who can provide drug testing and personalized treatment plans to help these students stay sober. And now it's because of this specialized environment that some students travel more than an hour each way to get to school. And a lot of the students who I've talked to say that the support that they get from these communities is vital to helping them stay sober and learn who they are without drugs.
And have you've been in these schools, buildings, and reporting on this over the last bit of time?
Yeah, over the last few years.
So there is an opioid crisis in the U.S. There's very much so one in the state of Massachusetts. Are there more students with this kind of addiction in these schools? And is that why? Does that contribute to these schools being more in demand?
They figured out a way to be able to get more students to the schools with transportation. So there's always been a need for these schools. But now with more funding for transportation, they have figured out a way to get these students to the schools. But there are more of them being opened across the country, too.
Is there more schools needed because of the opioid crisis, or is that, you know, sort of, it's a part of it, but not necessarily?
That's certainly a part of it. Yeah, a lot of the students are struggling with opioid addictions.
Talk about more about transportation. So five schools around the state, students may have to go from, let's say, Cape Cod to a school in Brockton. That is expensive. It's not a bus full of students. It is, it seems like, individualized transportation.
It could be a van, or some parents are responsible or guardians for getting the students to the school, or even their responsible for figuring it out themselves. So the state budget currently funds transportation costs for regional school districts, vocational schools, and for homeless students, but not for recovery high school students. So that's why many of these students who are coming to the recovery high schools from districts in the area need to figure out a way to get there. Of course. So under federal law, school districts are required to provide services to students with disabilities to meet their educational and mental health needs, but they're not required to transport students on the sole basis of their substance abuse disorder, which is why the recovery high schools have had to make up the cost.
And if these students are in halfway houses or are considered homeless because they might be in foster care, which is a federal designation, as I understand it, is there other federal money that could, do you know if that could help in transportation paying for transportation costs? Our schools, I mean, maybe we can ask that when we get to the school building itself.
Yeah, that could be helpful in paying for them, but there is still a huge need for transportation funding for the five existing recovery high schools.
So getting to that, in Massachusetts, it's possible that schools could receive less funding, as I understand it, overall next year in the big picture. How is it that possible when the needs are very clearly there? I mean, a lot of districts will say this as well. And talk about the House amendments right now that are making their way around Beacon Hill. What would they do to make a difference in the funding?
Sure. So the governor's budget proposed $2.475 million. And now the governor's office has said that that's level funded. But advocates for these schools say that that doesn't include money that the five schools have split over the past few years that has come from the Department of Public Health. So that's where the House budget comes in. There's a new amendment from Representative Liz Malia of Boston, which would allocate $3.6 million to the five recovery high schools. And it also increases the base level funding for each school. So right now, each school gets $500,000 from the state, but under this new amendment, they'd get $620,000 each.
All right. WBUR reporter Allison Poley, thank you so much for joining us today. And you can read her whole story at radioboston.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to continue this conversation about recovery schools in Massachusetts and across the country as well. We're joined by phone by Andy Finch. He's a professor at Vanderbilt University who specializes in the topic of recovery schools. Welcome to you, Andy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you. We're also joined in the studio by Ryan Morgan, who's a principal at the Independence Academy Sober Recovery High School in Brockton. It's one of five. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to be able to continue this conversation. Can you please discuss, if you would, Mr. Morgan, who the students are at Independence Academy and what a day looks like?
Sure. Thank you. The students at Independence Academy come from the region of southeastern Massachusetts. They're high school age students, you know, ranging in ages from 14 to, I think, 19 is our oldest student. And I think if you walked in the schools of Independence Academy, you would kind of be shocked that the population that you're looking at is a population that struggles with the things that they struggle with. And
why is that? I mean, why would I be shocked?
I think when you talk to people about, you know, adolescents who struggle with addiction and struggle with some of the issues that our students struggle with, everybody has kind of painted this picture in their mind of what a recovery high school student might look like, or what, you know, a student who's diagnosed with a substance use disorder at 15, you know, might look like. And I think if you walked in and you looked at our students, you'd see just a group of great kids who are all, you know, really working hard at trying to, you know, get their diploma and maintain sobriety, and you know, just a friendly group of kids with smiling faces. And you know, it's certainly not all always, you know, I don't know, beautiful and perfect, but it's just it's a great group of kids. And
but there are these issues that got them there in the first
Sure.
place, which behind those issues are other issues. I would imagine that addiction is what got them there. Not being able to thrive, I guess, in their own high school got them to your school or to the other schools in the state. What's the tipping point that brought them into your school? What happens enough that somebody has to leave their district?
Yeah, I think most of our students have completed substance use treatment, inpatient substance use treatment, and you know, it's not the first time that they've been caught with a substance, or first time that they've been found under the influence of a substance, or been identified as maybe struggling. I think it's, for many of our students, it's been a long road of, you know, losing relationships and losing opportunities, and just negative school experiences, just given kind of the current climate of how to address a student who struggles with substance use in a public high school, usually is grounded in suspension or some sort of disciplinary action. So, you know, students who are really working hard at trying to maintain sobriety and work on their recovery, you know, are looking for an environment that understands them, that's non-judgmental, and that, you know, in addition to working with them on their academics, really takes a head-on approach to helping them figure out, you know, the different domains of their life that are certainly necessary to facilitate recovery and are impacted by substance use.
All right. Andy Finch, joining us by phone at Vanderbilt, can you help us take a step back and look at the bigger picture of these kinds of schools around the country? How many of there are there, for instance, and how much has that number grown in the past few years?
Yeah, there's about 40 of them nationally right now that we're aware of, and you do see them clustered in certain states like Massachusetts that does have a funding model that has supported the schools. We've seen rapid growth, especially since about 2000, the late 1990s, but these schools have been around for quite a while. The first school that we know of opened in Maryland in 1979. And so, you know, we've had recovery high schools in the country for quite a while, but certainly in the late 90s, early 2000s, when we started to see innovative types of funding, more open enrollment type policies in states around the country, schools like this fit right into that pocket. We did see some decline during the recession when states were tightening the belt, and oftentimes it became difficult to sustain specialty programming. But certainly since about 2013-2014, we've seen really rapid growth in the number of schools and a real increase in demand.
So to clarify, that decline was not because of a decline in the number of kids needing these services, but as you're saying, a decline in budgets. I want to ask both Ryan Morgan from the school in Brockton and Andy Finch, both of you, how do schools, if you can describe, how do they balance helping a student with a big issue like recovering from addiction, but also teach them what they need to learn in high school to be able to graduate? And if the goal is still with this general idea, graduate, go off, learn a trade, go to college, is that a hard balance? And is it also about just keeping them alive? Ryan Morgan, if we could start with you as from a school-based perspective.
Yeah, I think it's really it's a difficult balance. And I think that that's why, in my opinion, recovery high schools need to be their standalone schools as opposed to being a program that's run, you know, within an existing school, because the balance is so hard to strike. At certain days, you have to just kind of put recovery first and, you know, make sure that that student is healthy and in many cases, you know, has a place to stay and is certainly safe. And so a lot of our efforts with students who are in early recovery is really focused on a lot of that, and you kind of work in academics when that student's ready. But, you know, I personally would like to kind of get rid of the whole, you know, you're a senior now because it's your fourth year in high school and you need to graduate. I'd rather, you know, take more of an individualized approach and say, you know, we're going to keep you here an extra year because, you know, yeah, we want you to graduate, but we want you to be healthy and we want you to be stable before we do that. So it is a difficult balance.
And Andy Finch at Vanderbilt, I imagine that your research on these types of schools takes you inside of buildings, at least I hope it does. And I wonder if you're seeing different styles or different models of how schools are managing to strike this balance.
And certainly, and I've been involved in a couple of national research studies in which I have had the opportunity to visit schools across the country, and it's true. You do see different models. And matter of fact, you really don't see just one type of recovery high school. They develop around what resources are available in their communities, what types of treatment is available to students. And so there are pieces of them that look very different, and yet at their heart, they are very similar in that they are supporting the long-term recovery of students. I think the population that he's just described in Brockton would be a similar population that you would see in schools around the country, and their programming is pretty similar as well.
But say, if you could say more about that programming, yeah. Meaning what does a day look like, striking that balance? What does the day begin with? What does it end with? What kinds of classes are there?
The balance between recovery and academics is always there. And I think they are identified as recovery schools because they're supporting that long-term recovery. But at the end of the day, they're academic institutions. They're trying to help students earn a diploma. And they're not treatment centers. That's not their purpose. And so supporting that long-term recovery means that students might be there a couple of years in some cases, maybe longer. And so it is a school. And so when you ask about that day to day, you're going to see academics going on. Now, you might see smaller class sizes of about 10 students. But when you walk into that class, you'll see students doing math. You'll see them doing English, science. But what you'll also see are perhaps support groups built in to the day, maybe the whole school or maybe a portion of the school. Or in the audio clip you just played, you see a real focus on the individual student need. So if a student is in crisis, whether it's around drug use, mental health, or something else, they have the ability to tune into that student. And it's okay for that student to say, see a counselor, talk to a recovery coach, or just step aside and talk to a teacher about their struggles. And that's welcome.
So
the last thing that I would emphasize is that it is an environment that it's very supportive peer supports. You don't see the power of teacher over student so much. It's much more seen as a collaborative environment. And so the entire culture would feel different than what we might see in most of our traditional schools in the country.
And I want to zero in, Andy Finch, on something you said, which is that the schools are not treatment centers. So Ryan Morgan in Brockton at the Independence Academy Sober Recovery High School, if they're not treatment centers, that means that are you also needing to ensure that these kids are getting additional services when they leave school? Is that more, you know, I don't mean to use the term warm handoff, which is a term used in the world of opioid addiction, but who are you handing off these kids to at the end of the day?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question mark for us. And what we try to do is connect kids with resources in their communities. And so whether it's an in-home therapist or a mentor or a peer group, you know, outside of the school, you know, that's part of our pitch. It's, if you look at SAMHSA's four, you know, kind of dimensions for their, you know, approach to recovery, it's home, health, community, and purpose. And, you know, we really focus on those four facets and try to get students to identify the supports that are in their community. We try to work on their home and try to, you know, educate their family as well, and work with their family. A lot of times families have presenting issues as well as a unit. And so, again, the recovery counselor, a clinician that's working within our school, you know, does a lot of family work during the day. And I think, like Dr. Finch said, you know, there's some individualized focus for kids who are in crisis. There's some small group and there's some large group. And there's also a strong family component that we try to incorporate into the work that we do
right,
as well.
Right. None of this happens without, you know, in a vacuum. We have about a minute left. I just want to ask you if you both can get an answer in. We'll see what happens. The issues behind this. What is going on in, and, you know, we can probably make some guesses, in our communities, in our systems, that there's more of a need for these schools? And maybe, Ryan Morgan, if you can begin, because you're based in one.
Sure. And I'll be quick. I think what's going on is that adolescent substance use and mental health and trauma is certainly becoming more and more prevalent. And I think that there's some substances that people are glossing over due to the opioid epidemic, particularly the substances that adolescents particularly start using around 11 or 12. And I think that, you know, we need to make a concerted effort on working with students who aren't necessarily using opioids, but, you know, start addressing issues around marijuana use at 11 and 12, especially chronic marijuana use, alcohol use, and over-the-counter prescription pills.
Right, more available. And Andy Finch, as a researcher, are you seeing a trend that you can point to that says, wow, this is absolutely there. It needs to be addressed. I mean, what's happening in the school building is one thing, but the bigger picture of addressing the issues.
I certainly think we've been seeing a larger number of overdose deaths, which I think has brought attention to this issue, perhaps like we've not seen in decades. And so I think for that reason, there's more funding available. I think the need has been pretty constant, quite honestly. I think that we've had a need for programs for many, many years. And I think what we're finally seeing are people stepping up and saying, we want schools like this in our community. And I think there's finally funding available to support them. So you're seeing an expansion of the program.
Right. And more, of course, to say on the funding question in Massachusetts, at least, as things are in the lurch a bit. Andy Finch at Vanderbilt University, researcher in the Recovery Schools Movement. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Morgan, good luck to you on back as the school year begins to wrap up, I imagine. I would love to know what a success looks like really quickly. Have you sent kids back into their district?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, we send kids back to district. We keep kids until graduation. We transition kids to high-set programs and colleges and things like that. So, you know, I would say we have a whole range of exit options for kids. And, you know, we continue to try to just make sure that the kids are healthy, I think, is the number one thing.
All right. Stay in touch with us. Ryan Morgan, thank you so much. Principal at the Independence Academy Sober Recovery High School in Brockton.
Thank you.
This week, most students in Boston are on vacation, but at 28 schools playing host to what are known as acceleration academies, another type of school, struggling students and teachers are working hard to get ahead. As WBUR's Max Larkin reports, the approach is a collision between two different ideas of education reform.
Chanel Andrews is pretty new to teaching.
I came in 2014? This is my fourth year.
If summoning her exact start date takes a second, it may be because those have been four difficult years. Just as Andrews started working at the Henry Grew Elementary School in Hyde Park, Massachusetts Education Commissioner labeled it one of the state's most poorly performing schools. That meant its teachers were laid off and asked to reapply for their jobs. Those who stayed faced hours of extra training, uncertainty, and high turnover, all while officials held the school under the microscope.
They come in, they interview teachers, they take observations on what they see. They try to rate us on like how we're doing in certain categories, like how we're doing with parent-family communication, how we're doing with instructional planning.
Andrews is one of just four teachers to have stayed on throughout the turnaround process. Teachers' unions have long criticized that heavy-handed approach to struggling schools, Boston Teachers Union President Jessica Tang says the district has practiced mass layoffs for years with little evidence that it really does turn around poor performance. And it comes at an enormous cost.
You're tearing apart the relationships between the students and the teachers, the parents and the teachers. You lose institutional knowledge. It is harmful.
Meanwhile, Tang says, schools where class sizes are small and teachers are trusted tend to thrive. This winter, Chanel Andrews put in a lot more extra hours trying to build just that kind of educational environment at the GRU. Andrews was coordinating the school's Acceleration Academy, a one-week crash course over February vacation.
All right, you guys ready?
Yes!
At the GRU, that meant the school cafeteria was turned into a combination workshop, classroom, and performance space. On a stage, three third-grade boys launched into a Caribbean dance they had choreographed. Meanwhile, in the back of the cafeteria, other students built instruments out of household objects while teachers looked on. Andrews designed this interdisciplinary curriculum with her fellow teachers. It's got STEM, history, cultural heritage education. Third-grader Joy Robinson sat designing her Cuban guitar out of cardboard.
Does it feel like school?
No. Because you get to do different things like dance, math, reading. And my favorite thing is basically dance and research.
About 1,500 students are taking part in similar academies at 27 other Boston schools over February and April vacations this year. They're designed to pair schools' most dedicated teachers with a handful of students who are still finding their footing. Their goal is to turn around academic performance, but not by the drill and kill tactics sometimes employed in the past.
It's not test prep in any way. It's really about quality instruction. You know, kids are excited by it. They want to participate. They want to be in school on vacations because they have these opportunities.
That's Jeff Riley. He first dreamed up the idea 10 years ago when he was principal of a Boston middle school. There's evidence that it works. Education experts at Harvard who studied acceleration academies in Lawrence found that they increased performance by impressive margins. That's the paradox. A reform for schools that have fallen behind on test scores is making progress by focusing, it seems, on everything but. Riley says this kind of educational experience is rare in urban schools.
The reality is we don't often get to have classes with 10 to 12 kids in them, right? And that's not the ideal situation.
He calls this the adrenaline shot version, forming small, close-knit academies over week-long vacations. Last month, Jeff Riley was appointed the state's new commissioner of education. From that post, he'll oversee which schools are judged to be failing and what will happen to them. Riley says he believes test scores are still an important tool, but he does see problems with the way struggling schools have been handled up till now.
There was some blaming of teachers in the past, and I think that's a really wrong way to look at it. We need to celebrate them, and we need to support them and recognize that they are on the front lines and are doing the work with the kids.
That was February vacation at the GRU. This April, another teacher is running another academy, and instead of being in Hyde Park, Chanel Andrews is on a staff trip to Scandinavia, visiting top schools there and learning how to be a better teacher.
That's WBUR reporter Max Larkin. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.